headlines. Iran's capital, Tehran, is hosting the first International Congress on Influential Women, bringing together participants from more than 90 countries. The US announces a new military aid package for Ukraine that includes hundreds of armored vehicles, rockets, and artillery shells. And the US president says he has no regrets about his handling of classified documents found at his home and former office. Welcome to World News from the reigning capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our first story this hour, the first International Congress on Influential Women has kicked off in the reigning capital, Tehran, bringing participants from more than 90 countries. Women from different sectors are in attendance. They include actresses, academics, lawmakers, environment and civil rights activists, as well as healthcare workers, among many others. At the end of the gathering, three women regarded influential in the world will be presented with an award. On Thursday, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi met with some of the top attendees. He said such events can pave the way for international cooperation in the future. The Iranian president praised the great role women have played throughout history. He also expressed hope that participants attending the Congress can benefit from Iran's experiences in upholding women's rights.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The two-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in peace-building process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have a peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in three fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication, the country, the for example, Algeria, the woman Algeria and the woman Iraq, and we take the relation very important because the Islam it's number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Staying in Iran, where the country's President Ibrahim Raisi has denounced the European Parliament for making an attempt to put the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on the EU's terror list. Raisi says the decision was made out of utter desperation. The Iranian president said the attempt is against international law and the United Nations Charter. He said the move came after the EU's efforts to hurt the Iranian nation over the recent riots went down the drain. The European Parliament made the decision to blacklist the IRGC earlier on Thursday. The Parliament says sanctions targeting Tehran had to be expanded following the recent riots in Iran. The bill is non-binding and musters a majority of EU member states for punitive measures to counter Iran's, quote, swift backsliding in the human rights issue. We were earlier joined by author and journalist Robert Fantina. He gave us his opinion on the European Union's plan to blacklist the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and how the bloc uses human rights as a political tool. Let's take a listen to that.
The thing that was most striking about this whole situation with the EU increasing sanctions was talking about what they described as Iran's backsliding human rights issue. Why do these countries then not sanction Israel, which has an atrocious human rights record? Why not Saudi Arabia? Why don't they sanction Saudi Arabia? Why are they picking Iran? It's simply because the government of Iran doesn't kowtow or toe the line of U.S. and Western demands. Because of that, these countries in the EU and the U.S. and so on they want to make Iran and the Iranians suffer. But this fantasy about punishing one country for human rights violations when it overlooks and even supports the human rights violations of other countries is complete hypocrisy.
The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the U.S. is pursuing a policy of maximum pressure and sanctions against the resistance front in the region. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said Iran, Syria, Yemen, and other members of the resistance front are targets of the U.S. pressure campaign. He added that Washington's pressure on these countries is because they do not want to surrender to U.S. diktats. The leader of Hezbollah said the U.S. is also behind the decades-long economic woes in Lebanon. He said Washington obstructs financial aid to Lebanon one way or another and does not allow any country to offer assistance to Beirut to help it meet its needs. Turning elsewhere, Japan is feeling the pinch of skyrocketing energy costs as official data shows consumer prices rose at a level not seen since December 1981. Japan's consumer prices rose 4% in December from a year earlier. The figure was also up by 0.3% compared with November. The increase in prices of telecommunication fees as well as a range of processed foods also contributed to the December acceleration. The figure is below record inflation rates in the US and Europe, yet it exceeds the inflation goal of 2% set by the Bank of Japan. The bank, however, has so far resisted calls to increase interest rates to tackle inflation. It says the price increases are temporary and linked to events like the Ukraine war and soaring energy prices. Washington has announced a new package of military assistance for Kiev as the West continues to fan the flames of war in Ukraine. The U.S. Defense Department says the new package includes hundreds of armored vehicles, rockets, and artillery shells valued at up to $2.5 billion. The U.S. says 59 Bradley fighting vehicles and 90 Stryker armored personnel carriers are included in the package. It also consists of ammunition for high-mobility artillery rocket systems and 8 Avenger air defense systems. The latest package brings total U.S. military assistance to Ukraine to more than $27.4 billion. Russia says the West's military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war and increase the suffering of its people. Other Western countries have also pledged to provide Ukraine with more weapons. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, tells us about those pledges as well as Russia's stance over the arms deliveries.
There seems to be an increasing split now, and this is very much a crucial point, I think, in terms of how far NATO and indeed how far particular specific countries are going to go in supporting Ukraine. The Americans say they're not going to give any of their, at the moment anyway, they say they're not going to give any of their Abrams tanks. They say it's not logistically feasible to do so. The British, as I said, are only giving a few tanks. And they're trying to, the British and the Americans are trying to pressure the Germans into giving their tanks. And the Germans have hundreds of Leopard tanks, and they've also sold hundreds of these tanks to other countries around Europe, which need German agreement to send them to Ukraine. Now, these hundreds of tanks could well have an effect on the battlefield, but at the moment, German politicians are standing back from that. So we may well be seeing a crucial moment in this split that has been going on in NATO for some time between the United States, Britain, Poland, the Baltic states, and Germany and France. And I think many people in Germany are starting to wonder, and politicians as well, not just people, starting to wonder whether continuing to give particularly heavy weapons to Ukraine is really in European interests. At the moment on the front lines, it's Russia very much on the ascendancy. And so when the Russians say that continuing to give weapons to Ukraine is only going to prolong the war, many people will agree with them.
Now, U.S. President Joe Biden says he has no regrets, that is, about his handling of classified documents found at his home and former office.
As we found a handful of documents were failed, were filed in the wrong place. We immediately turned them over to the archives of the Justice Department. We're fully cooperating, looking forward to getting this resolved quickly. I think you're going to find there's nothing there. I have no regrets. I'm following what the lawyers have told me they want me to do. It's exactly what we're doing. There's no there there. Thank you.
Those were the first public comments by President Biden since last week. That's when a special counsel was named to investigate the matter. The documents have been found at Biden's home in Wilmington and a Washington, D.C. office he used before becoming president. The first set was discovered in early November, but news of the documents broke out on January 9. Biden and his advisors are facing criticism over why the White House has kept quiet on the matter for so long. In September, Biden criticized his Republican predecessor, Donald Trump, for having classified documents at his Florida residence home. Elsewhere, thousands of people from across Peru have poured into the capital, Lima, renewing calls on President Dina Boluarte to step down. They've also expressed outrage over rising deaths during weeks of protests.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice, also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
Police estimate that around 3,500 people took part in the rally in Lima. The rally turned violent with clashes between security forces and protesters. A historic building was caught on fire. Some said a tear gas grenade fired by police ignited the blaze. The unrest spilled over to other cities as well. Protesters in three southern cities were reportedly trying to take over airports. The president has pledged to punish those behind the violence.
That was not a peaceful protest. The violent acts that occurred in December and January will not go unpunished.
Peru has been gripped by unrest since the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo in December. He is in pretrial detention for attempting to shutter Congress to avoid an impeachment. The protesters want early elections as well as the release of Castillo from prison. Nearly 50 people have been killed across the country since the unrest broke out. Moving on, Yemenis are calling on their government to end talks with the United Nations since UN efforts have failed to stop the ongoing suffering of millions of Yemenis due to the Saudi-led coalition's war and blockade on Yemen. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our weekly episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we started explanation of Surah Jum'ah, which has 11 ayahs, and today we will complete it. Revealed in Medina, it opens with the glorification of Allah and the Prophet's call. It enjoins believers to proceed to the ritual congregational prayer on Fridays by quitting all commercial transactions on hearing the azan, or the call to prayer. It says, Muslims are not supposed to be like the Jews to whom God granted the Torah, but they failed to act upon it. Here, we invite you to listen to ayahs 6, 7, and 8.
قُلْ يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ هَادُوا إِنْ زَعَمْتُمْ أَنَّكُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ لِلَّهِ مِنْ دُونِ النَّاسِ فَتَمَنَّوُا الْمَوْتَ إِنْ كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ وَلَا يَتَمَنَّوْنَهُ أَبَدًا بِمَا قَدَّمَتْ أَيْدِيهِمْ والله عليم بالظالمين قل إن الموت الذي تفرون منه فإنه ملاقيكم ثم تردون إلى عالم الغيب والشهادة فينبئكم بما كنتم تعملون
Say, O Prophet, O you who are Jews, if you claim that you are Allah's favorites, to the exclusion of other people, then long for death, should you be truthful. Yet, the Jews will never long for it because of what their hands have sent ahead, and Allah knows best the wrongdoers. Say, O Prophet, to the Jews, indeed, the death that you flee from will surely encounter you. Then you will be returned to the knower of the seen and the unseen, and he will inform you about what you used to do. If you remember, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said the mission of the Prophet of Islam is not exclusive to the Arabs or the people of his time, but it is for all humanity, including people of all ethnicities and of every place on planet Earth. We also said that the Jewish tribes in Medina used to mock at Islam and became deserving of censure for violating the tenets of the Torah, which gives the tidings of Prophet Moses of the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The ayahs that we recited to you now challenge the claim of the Jews to be the chosen people of God and tells them to desire death for themselves if they are truthful. In other words, if they are true in their claims to be the intimate friend, why are they engrossed in the mundane life and are fearful of death? The fact of the matter is that the Israelites had long deviated from the teachings of the Torah and distorted its contents by disobeying the prophets that came after Moses, especially Jesus and the Prophet of Islam. Ayah 7 says the main cause of their fear of death is the record of sins, which prevent them from yearning for death. The point is that a person fears death because of two reasons. Firstly, the lack of belief in the hereafter, which makes death appear as a monster ending existence and the pleasures of life. Secondly, despite belief in the hereafter, it is the fear of punishment in the afterlife that makes the sinner terrified of death. The next ayah commands the Prophet of Islam to tell the Jews that entertaining such anxiety and fear may not solve any problems, since death is in store for all human beings. The law of death is one of the most general and all-encompassing laws that ends the existence of all created things, whether animate or inanimate, including prophets, angels, mountains, and seas, Thus, no person can escape death and resurrection for the trial in the divine court on the day of judgment, on which the all-merciful Creator, who is aware of all and everything, including the visible and the invisible, will mete out justice. Compare and contrast this fear of death of the Jews with the readiness for death of the virtuous and spotlessly pure Muslims who smilingly court martyrdom. The most glaring example in this regard is the Prophet's vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, who risked his life at every turn to save Islam. From the night of migration, when the pagans hovered around the Prophet's house with naked swords, to every battle imposed by the Arabs and the Israelites, he used to say he was more familiar with death than an infant with the breast of its mother. When it struck the fatal sword blow on his head, which resulted in his martyrdom, Imam Ali, peace upon him, famously remarked, "I have succeeded by the Lord of the Kaaba." From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, readiness for death is the best means for evaluating the faith of those who claim to be the chosen persons of God. Number two, it is a cardinal sin to consider oneself or a community to be the favorites of God or even the children of God, since the Almighty Creator is far glorious and free of having any needs and the characteristics of his creatures. Number three, fear of death has its roots in evil deeds, and thus, in contrast to the sinners and disbelievers, the pious and righteous people fearlessly court martyrdom. Now let us listen to ayahs 9 and 10 of the same surah.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا نودي للصلاة من يوم الجمعة فاسعوا إلى ذكر الله وذروا البيع ذلكم خير لكم إن كنتم تعلمون فإذا قضيت الصلاة فانتشروا في الأرض وابتغوا من فضل الله واذكروا الله كثيرا لعلكم تفلحون.
O you who have faith, on the call for prayer on Friday, hurry toward the remembrance of Allah and leave all business. That is better for you, should you know. And when the prayer is finished, disperse through the land and seek Allah's grace and remember Allah greatly so that you may be felicitous. Among the days of the week, Friday is of particular significance. It is the day of providing more help to the deprived and the poor. A famous narration from the Prophet reads, "On Friday, God Almighty renders good deeds many folds and effaces evil deeds and promotes the ranks of the believers, wards off afflictions, and answers the prayers of the believers. Whoever visits the tomb of his parents, or either of them, his or her sins shall be forgiven, and his or her name recorded among the righteous. Moreover, it will be Friday when the Lord of the Age, the Prophet's last and 12th heir, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, will reappear in the end times to establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. Ayah 9 thus refers to significance of the special Friday congregational prayer at noon and its laws, which stipulates the leaving of business and other activities at that particular time in order to participate in this act of worship, which has many benefits. It is noteworthy that leaving of trade encompasses any activity interfering with the remembrance of God Almighty. The next ayah means to say that worldly possessions are divine bounties, and after completion of the Friday prayer, the believers can return to their trade and other lawful activities. The faithful ought to invoke the Almighty for bestowing His bounties and be in remembrance of Him at all times in order to avoid aimlessness and wrongdoing. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, participation in the Friday prayer and other congregational prayers is a sign of faith. Number two, no activity should prevent a believer from keeping away from the Friday prayer, and thus on this day, especially at noontime, markets are closed. And number three, the congregation prayer is a sign of the unity and strength of the believers, who are free to continue their business and other lawful activities after participating in this significant act of worship. With recitation of the 11th and last ayah of Surah Jum'ah, we come to the conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment.
وَإِذَا رَأَوْا تِجَارَةً أَوْ لَهْوًا فَضُّوا إِلَيْهَا وَتَرَكُوكَ قَائِمًا قُلْ مَا عِندَ اللَّهِ خَيْرٌ مِنَ اللَّهْوِ وَمِنَ التِّجَارَةِ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الرَّازِقِينَ.
When they see a deal or a diversion, they scatter off towards it and leave you, O Prophet, standing. Say, what is with Allah is better than diversion and dealing, and Allah is the best of providers. Once, when the Prophet of Islam was delivering the sermons of the Friday prayer, a trade caravan entered Medina beating its drums. Some of the Muslims left the congregation and hastened towards the merchandise, ignoring the Prophet's sermons. At this point, to censure their unworthy act, God Almighty revealed this ayah in order to make it known to Muslims that turning their backs on speech and admonishments of the divinely decreed leader is highly disrespectful, an act of disobedience toward God. It is God who created us and provides us sustenance. Therefore, we should not neglect worship and rituals by engaging in trade and amusement at these times. It is narrated from the Prophet that the one who participates in the Friday prayer with faith, his or her sins will be forgiven and he or she will proceed with a new life. From this ayah, we learn that number one, observance of the Friday prayer guarantees happiness in both this world and the hereafter. And number two, we should not involve ourselves in trade and other activities at the time of the Friday prayer. Dear listeners, next week, we take explanation of Surah Munafiqun. God bless you and goodbye.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has slammed Kiev's destructive policies and growing Western arms supplies to Ukraine. Reference to Poland and the UK in this case, who have said that they will provide main battle tanks. Now, Russia has said that this means that they want the conflict in Ukraine to spiral even further, adding that those tanks can burn, and they will burn like the rest of the weapons. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether this war will end on the battlefield or at the diplomatic table, something which the U.S. cannot come to grips with yet. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Moscow. Also joining us is Harley Schlanger, spokesman for the LaRouche organization, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Fred, we all start with you. The latest is Britain's decision to provide Ukraine with these tanks by the name of 14 Challenger. Two tanks is the name to help counter Russia, as it Downing Street has said, in the coming weeks. And the curious part about this, which I want to ask you, is that this is the first time that, as this was reported, a Western country has provided Ukraine with tanks. Why hasn't Ukraine received tanks before from a Western country?
Ukraine started the war with a lot of tanks. This is a sign, I guess, that they're pretty much drawn down their original arsenal. In fact, they've been resupplied several times. It's, I guess, also a sign that the Western countries are running out of ways to help Ukraine. I think that there have been several waves of, you know, weaponry, you know, starting at the beginning. You remember the Javelin missiles and all the hype about that. Then there were these HIMARS. And now it's about tanks and fighting vehicles. I think when the Russians say it won't make any difference on the battlefield, they're right in the big sense. It won't change the tide of war any more than the previous weapons did, but it will prolong the war. It will give the Ukrainians, because they have plenty of manpower, another set of armaments with which to launch new offensives.
All right, a couple points there, Harley Schlanger, that I want to ask you. First of all, what Fred Weir said is really important in order to grasp this, and that is why in waves there are these announcements that are made about weaponry. I mean, it's pretty much been going on for quite some time. My question would be, first, why don't they just come out and give them all? What's the problem there? Now, secondly, the fact that this won't change the tide of war based on the most recent deployment that Britain has said, and that is about these tanks.
Well, there are two points here that are important. First,
NATO's goal is a permanent war until it weakens Russia to the point where NATO can do whatever it wants. The problem that NATO and the West has, the transatlantic, the US, the Anglo-American side, their problem is that they're trying to stop the development of a new financial system, a new strategic orientation away from Europe. And this is already occurring with Russia, with China, countries like India, the BRICS countries. They're moving in a different direction. And so
can you repeat that one more time? I'm trying to understand what you just said, so if you don't mind repeating it one more time, I'm sorry.
Sure. Why is NATO committed to a permanent war against Russia? Because Russia refuses to accept the idea of a Western rules-based order, which is not based on rules, it's not based on international law, it's based on the supremacy of the financial empire out of London and Wall Street. And unfortunately, European countries submit to that. And so that's why they're providing waves of weapons. They thought the sanctions would destroy Russia. The sanctions didn't. They thought that they could turn the world against Russia and isolate Russia. They didn't. In fact, Russia is less isolated today than ever with alliances such as the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and others. So the idea that more weapons will weaken Russia is the only thing they have. And the problem they have is that it's not going to win a war, but they're committed to permanent warfare. And that's something that people in the West don't understand. They believe the lie that Russia is losing, that Ukraine will win, and if we just provide a little bit more weapons, that will turn the tide. One final point on this. The United Kingdom is going through a horrible economic crisis, and the question has to be raised, how can Sunak justify sending more weapons when the British economy is on its back? There are strike waves, the population is angry. So I think the West has a losing hand, but they're going to continue the war as long as they can.
I'm curious as to why you picked the UK and not Germany.
Well, Germany is also facing a problem, but Germany still has more production and more riches than the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is quite weak economically, except for the city of London. But the problem is paper money and computer notations don't win a war. And NATO is trying to force Germany to provide more weapons, and there's resistance in Germany.
Okay. Taking a look at the notion of what our guest there, Harley Schlanger, said, Fred Weir, the whole notion of where this war is going to define which side has won or not, that's a big question mark. And who's to judge how that's going to happen? But at some point, that is bound to happen, especially given the way that we're seeing some of the important developments unfold, such as the batch of, again, military, not only military weaponry, but also the fact that we are getting reports, as I'm sure you're well aware, that both NATO and the U.S. and some of these European countries are running out of ammunition. They're running out of weaponry. So where is that going to, when is that going to reach, what time frame, and what is the definition of who has lost or who has won?
That's a huge question, and I can't answer it. I think there's a lot more, to be sad to say, to be played out on the battlefield. I think that what's going on in Donbass, whatever offensives are coming up before spring or by spring, may give us a much clearer idea of how the war can end. But however it does end, there's no doubt that the world system, that globalization that we experienced over the past 30 years or so, and for some of us, for a lot of people in the global south, but for people like me, that was a really great time. If you had money, if you were prosperous, you could travel, you could enjoy cheap consumer goods. There was just almost no limit to the possibilities in that economic system, and that is fracturing now. We're going to end up with a divided world, with probably countries like Russia, Iran, China, on one side, not just politically or geopolitically, but also economically, and the West on in another realm, not perhaps quite like it was in the old Cold War, not an ideologically divided world, or so strictly divided, but still not a functioning global system. And that will be the outcome of this war, no matter who supposedly wins it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, we seem to be going on to this economically driven point that is being made, especially when rules-based order, as you mentioned there, Harley Schlanger, is what Russia seems to be fighting. But isn't Russia leading the way towards a system that did not have positive results? Way back, not even that far back, from 2008 up to now, and we're seeing what the world is in terms of the economic doldrums that it's in, of course, taking away COVID, and I'm just saying what my knowledge is on this, and that's the printing of money that somewhat has led the world into the situation that it's in. Briefly, though, talk to us and tell us what this rules-based order is that Russia is fighting, that the West, led by the U.S., feels that it has to go to war and for lives need to be lost in order to preserve it.
Well, it's not just Russia that's fighting it. As Fred mentioned, the global South is refusing to support the efforts to destroy and isolate Russia because they know what colonialism is all about. They've been fighting it. This is the old non-aligned movement, which is reemerging. Now, on the economy, look, the United States on Friday will hit its debt ceiling, which means it's been bailing out bankrupt corporations to the extent that they can keep printing money, but if they keep doing it, the inflation goes off the charts again. So the West has a limitation as to what it can do right now with the post-industrial order. What it intends to do, and what I mean by the rules-based order, is the control by international banks, Washington, Wall Street, and the City of London and Brussels. These are banks and institutions that have been looting the global South for years. And they're the ones that insist that no nation has a right to sovereignty. They have to abide by the rules of the bankers. Now, the Russians are committed to sovereignty. The Chinese are committed to sovereignty. So are the Indians, the Egyptians, the Brazilians. And so there's a natural orientation away from that. Now, the war is designed by the West to convince the rest of the world that you shouldn't work with Russia because Russia can be beaten. But I think what we're seeing is the loss of support for the West because of its commitment to policies that so many countries have experienced in the past and are looking to escape. So we are in the question of who is lost and who is won. And in a sense, the military side is clear. Eventually, Russia will succeed, but at what cost? The more important question is, will a new monetary system come into existence? And just one other point here. I don't think Europe is going to stick with London and Wall Street, because I'm seeing very clear signs from France, from Germany, from Switzerland, from Italy, of a move away. They need Russia and China for resources and for markets. And I think that's why the change is inevitably against the unipolar order. The problem is they have a lot of weaponry to try and keep it in place.
So when we talk about the West, Fred Weir, if you agree with our guests there from Germany, what's there left of the West, the U.S. and... Fred Weir, hold on to your thought. We're unfortunately getting cut off intermittently. So let me ask you that question then, Harley Schlanger. When we talk about the West, based on what you just said, who would be left? You have the U.S. and who else?
Well, it's the U.S. and the United Kingdom and Brussels. Now, if you look at Germany, Germany is having to tolerate something that's intolerable. The pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline, was blown up. That was a Russian-German cooperation. The Germans are in Germany now, we're dependent on solar power and wind power. They're trying to scrounge gas and oil from around the world, and we're not getting enough of it. A cold wave is about to hit, and we're going to see some real problems hitting the economy in Germany and also in France. So I think that the attempt to keep this alliance together by placing demands for more weapons, a gearing up of its industrial production, the West can't produce the weapons that are needed by Ukraine, or at least that are demanded by Ukraine. And Ukraine is running out of Soviet-era weapons, and NATO is depleting its stocks. Even in the United States, without an industrial, a real investment in armaments, and of course, $112 billion, that's a pretty big investment. But they're not going to have enough capability to continue this war. So I really think that we're going to see a shift.
Yeah, let's expand on that, because we need to, Fred Weir, if we have you, on this supply side of the topic here. Based on just one example, and this would be the production lever for artillery rounds for the howitzer. It's said that a long-range heavy artillery weapons that are currently used on the battlefields of Ukraine is about 30,000 rounds per year during peacetime. But with the Ukrainian soldiers fighting Russian forces, they go through that amount in roughly 2 weeks. There's no way that they can actually keep up with the production for that particular item. Now, you can go down the list here. So how can they even sustain, first of all, fighting Russia? And B, if this is the case, doesn't this mean that they have to make a decision? Unless the decision, which apparently is to continue, so they could ramp up production to meet the demands of the battlefield for Ukraine.
It will take some time, even if they do decide to go on a war footing. I think it was a U.S. Navy secretary who said the other day, I guess he was speaking out of turn, that within 6 months, the United States Navy will have to make a decision whether we're going to arm Ukraine or arm the United States Navy. They are up against it in terms of production, and it would require massive investments to go onto a war footing, as, for instance, the United States did do in World War II, very fast, and which Russia is now doing. It's not well reported, but the Russian economy is now in full mobilization mode, and all defense and defense-related industries are running three shifts a day, 7 days a week. The Russian side is ramped up to a full war footing, or will be pretty soon. They're also mobilizing. The math is in Russia is pretty solid for an effective war effort. In terms of Ukraine, which now is entirely supplied, it's completely dependent on Western imports for all of its military needs. It doesn't have any of the Soviet-era weapons left, the 152-millimeter artillery that was Soviet standard is all gone, and they're now using 155-millimeter NATO standard, which means that all the shells, not just the artillery pieces, but everything that keeps them running has to be imported every day. It is a massive strain on Western industry, which is not going on. I mean, it's simply they're digging into reserves, stockpiles, and so on, but they are not putting their industry on a full war footing, which they would have to do if this war is going to go on, for more than a few more months.
If I could make a point there.
Yes, please, go ahead.
The U.S. and the British are also short of skilled labor. that even if they wish to have a mobilization, this is one of the discussions going on in the Pentagon right now, that they have a labor shortage and they have people who don't want to go to work in the defense sector. The other problem Ukraine has is they not only need all their weapons imported, they need funds to run the government. They're being totally subsidized by the European Union and the United States. So the real question then is, why not negotiate? Why is the U.S. so insistent that there be no negotiation? And that gets to the point I was making. The concern for the U.S. is to maintain the old rules-based order, the imperial system. And there's no way they can do that short of maybe a provocation to nuclear war. And that's the danger. That's why negotiations have to take place. That's why my organization is fighting like crazy to bring the NATO countries and the United States population to say to the government, no more war, we can't afford it.
Well, when you talk about the case of the UK that you mentioned, and also we should talk about Germany and other European countries for that matter, Fred Weir, let's take the UK as an example. I mean, how much clearer can the writing be on the wall when you have the year 2023 starting out with a bang, with strikes from different sectors that came through from last year? I mean, also this year, this week, we noticed the humongous crowds that showed up in Portugal. We're talking about also crowds in different European countries. I think that's pretty evident. And yet you're having Germany that had, what, 100 billion euros? That's a special fund for Ukraine, the U.S. Well, gosh, I lost count there, but, you know, we're looking at about $70 billion there. And then the U.K., $1.5 billion, the UK so far for Ukraine. Is that accurate? I think it is. $304 million in new military aid was just announced by Rishi Sunak. How are you going to answer to the people?
Well, I wouldn't underestimate the resilience of these societies and these political systems. I live in Russia. I'm a journalist in Russia, and I have to deal every day with catastrophic assessments of how Russia is going down the tubes and is doomed. And I see around me a lot of resilience in the society, in the political system. And so I don't want to go with those alarmist assessments. But yes, there's intense strain, and it's of a systemic nature in Britain, but also in Germany, which built its industrial prowess in the past 30 years on cheap Russian energy. You see a lot of German industries now looking to relocate to places where energy is cheaper because they simply cannot afford it. These are systemic alarm signals that are visible. I wouldn't overestimate them. I wouldn't look for collapse anytime soon. It's definitely tectonic plates are shifting in the world today, and this war is a catalyst for them.
Unfortunately, we're just out of time here. Do apologize. Thank you, though. Harley Schlanger, spokesman for the La Ruche organization. Fred Weir, thank you so much. Journalist and political commentator there from Moscow. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakhle and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.